Accountability chart clarifies who is accountable for what. With this level of clarity, it's time to put all the right people into the right seats. To do that, you need only one filter, GWC. GWC stands for Get It, Want It, and Capacity to Do It. GWC is a tool that stemmed from thousands of hours of working with leaders. The concept crystallized for me while sitting in a coffee shop with a client. We were discussing why one of his moves, that of elevating one of his key people to the role of integrator, hadn't yet borne fruit. He had the right person, but the promotion hadn't worked. At that moment, the answer to a question that had been bothering me clicked into place. After hundreds of sessions, I suddenly understood why filling seats hadn't worked for some. I explained the concept of GWC to him. As a result of the clarity GWC gave him, he immediately realized he had made a wrong seat mistake. The person who got the job had wanted it, but didn't have the capacity to do it. That person was promptly removed from the role and put in a more suitable position where he now excels. The discovery came after observing many who'd been given seats but did not step up and fully assume their roles. These people were not fully performing because one of the three factors was absent. They didn't get it, didn't want it, or didn't have the capacity to do the job. To reach the next level, you need the people that report to you to be able to take the ball and run with it. When you, as their leader or manager, clearly articulate the seat, including roles, responsibilities, expectations, and measurables, and present that opportunity, you have created an opening. One of two things will happen as a result. Either they will step up and take charge, or they never will. If they don't, it's because one of G, W, or C is missing. In this scenario, you'll be frustrated, they'll be frustrated, you'll never be able to delegate and elevate, and you'll always be forced to do some or all of their work. Let's break down these assets one at a time. Get it. You've seen people who get it and people who don't. Get it simply means that they truly understand their role, the culture, the systems, the pace, and how the job comes together. Not everyone gets it. The good news is that there are plenty who do. Want it. This means they genuinely like the job. They understand the role, and they want to do it based on fair compensation and the responsibility. In many instances, a manager feels the need to motivate, overpay, or beg a person to want it, when the reality is they don't. Sometimes their ego, your hopes, or their ignorance about what the job entails will lead them to think that they want it. But if they don't, they're never going to provide that spark, no matter how effective a manager you are. So stop beating your head against the wall. Find someone who does want it, and the difference will be immediately apparent. Capacity to do it. Capacity means having the time, as well as the mental, physical, and emotional capacity to do a job well. Sometimes a position might require a commitment of 55 hours a week, where the person is only willing to commit 40. Sometimes the job requires a certain level of intellect, skill, knowledge, and emotional intelligence, and the person doesn't have that capacity. This is the Peter Principle at its finest, where people are elevated to a level of incompetence. A no on any of these three means it's not the right seat for the person. It's not their unique ability. You must not fool yourself on this point. You can occasionally turn a no into a yes if you're willing to invest the time and money it takes to elevate a person. However, in most cases, you won't have the time to wait for them to adjust to the learning curve. Be careful not to assume you already have people to fill the major functions. Just because they currently have the job doesn't always mean that they get it, want it, and have the capacity. Using the filter of GWC will keep you honest with yourself. When Ronish Construction Group, a general contractor with revenues of $44 million and 37 employees, started the process, Bernie Ronish, the owner and integrator, had a leadership team of four. As an unbiased party, I can tell when someone is not going to cut it on the leadership team very early on, usually well before the integrator sees it. In this case, two out of the four members were not going to make it. That's 50% of the team. We struggled through the tasks of setting quarterly priorities, creating the accountability chart, and discovering core values, and then went through several quarters of poor completion on achieving those priorities. In a fit of frustration, I asked the two members directly how committed they were to this process on a scale of 1 to 10. They both gave a 4. That was all Bernie had to hear to make some tough changes. Though both were very talented, he removed them from the leadership team. One he let go and the other was moved to a superintendent role and shortly thereafter quit. Bernie replaced them with the right people in the right seats. 18 months later, the company grew 50% in that calendar year. Once a solid leadership team of five, Bernie added a major function, was firmly in place, they went to work on the rest of the company. Painfully, they turned over 40% of their employees. As a result, they now have the right people in the right seats organization-wide. 4 years after starting the EOS process, their growth of 70% last year put them seventh on the Crain's Detroit Business List of fastest-growing companies. They were also a finalist for the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. I've been tracking a statistic over the last 11 years regarding my client leadership team changes in their first 2 years of implementing EOS. The data shows that 80% of the time there's a change in the leadership team as a result of this process. This means that most of the time, the leadership team that you start with is not the one you will end up with. Half the time, the change is removing someone from the team, and half the time it's adding someone to the team. The point is this: if you're truly going to commit to building a great company, a strong leadership team, and getting the right people in the right seats, you must prepare for change on your leadership team. However, you may be one of the 20% in which there is no change. Life is much easier for everyone when you have people around you who genuinely get it, want it, and have the capacity to do it. With GWC Now Clear, incorporate it into your people analyzer. When you're evaluating your people, the rating on GWC should be a black and white yes or no, unlike the pluses and minuses for core values. You must get a yes on all three, or the person is in the wrong seat. One name, two seats. You can have one name in two seats, just not two names in one seat. When an organization first starts out, the founding entrepreneur occupies every seat. He or she is the one name in all seats. He or she is the integrator, the head of sales and marketing, the head of operations, and the head of finance. As the organization grows, new people are brought in to fill the seats needed. For instance, once the entrepreneur reaches capacity, he or she then brings in someone to run operations and is able to let go of that major function. If you're at a point where you have people in more than one seat, for instance, your bookkeeper is also your shipping person and your customer service person, that is okay as long as they have enough time to do both jobs well. It's a matter of the size of the organization. If they or you don't have enough time to be in all seats, that will have to change. This leads us to the next point. Delegate and elevate. As your company grows, you have to rise to your unique ability, and the same goes for your leadership team. With your accountability chart in place, you can now determine when someone is working at full capacity. Each person only has 100% of his or her working time. This 100% represents the amount of time each person is willing to work and still maintain balance. For some people, it's 40 hours per week, and for others, it's 70 hours. Everyone is different. When the amount of work requires more than 100% to do the job well, say 120%, something has to give. This person needs to delegate and elevate the extra 20% because he or she is holding the organization back and hitting the ceiling. In some cases, it's time to move this person into one seat rather than the two he or she is occupying right now. If this person is in one seat, he or she needs to delegate more to other people, realize some efficiency, or eliminate some tasks altogether. At all times, you want to make sure that this person is drawing closer and closer to his or her unique ability. For example, assume you have a great operations and great finance person in place, freeing you up from those major functions. Yet your workload is still requiring 120% of your time in order to lead and manage your leadership team as the integrator, manage the sales team, sell and create marketing materials. It's time to let go of something else. Assuming that leading and managing the leadership team and selling are your unique abilities, you must delegate managing the sales team and creating marketing materials to free up the 20%. Delegate to the right person in the right seat and elevate yourself to your unique ability. When you delegate and elevate, it's vital that you have the right person in the right seat. If you don't, you'll never feel completely comfortable letting go. You must also realize that you have no choice but to delegate. If you're at 120%, you're holding the organization back and probably starting to burn out. You no longer have the time to fully run the company and manage the sales team well, never mind those other jobs. If the only reason you're not letting go is because of the person occupying the seat, it's time to make that tough decision. You can't keep doing this person's work for him or her. You can't keep taking on his or her monkeys, as Hal Burroughs, William Unkin Jr., and Kenneth Blanchard illustrated so well in their book, The One-Minute Manager Meets the Monkey. Envision all of your direct reports' responsibilities, problems, and issues as monkeys. When your direct report walks into your office with a problem, he or she is trying to leave his or her monkey with you. At the end of the day, after multiple people have walked into your office with their problems and left them with you, you end up with 20 monkeys jumping around your office. If someone walks in with a monkey, he or she needs to walk out with it. If he or she can't or won't, you've hired the wrong person. Tyler Smith of Niche Retail is a textbook example of someone who has been able to constantly delegate and elevate as his organization has grown and continuously broken through new ceilings. When Tyler and his partner, Brad Sorok, started their internet retail company, with Tyler as integrator and Brad as visionary, Tyler handled all sales, operations, and finance, while Brad was in the lab researching and finding the next product idea and strategy. Tyler would get a ping on his cell phone indicating he had received an order, and he would go down to his basement and print the order, package it, and ship it out. He would then process the payment, order from his supplier, and pay the bills. This went on for the first year. As the business grew, he reached full capacity. He couldn't do all of his former jobs anymore. His first delegation and elevation was to his wife, Stacy, who helped him pack boxes. Soon they reached capacity again. He hired someone to help him ship orders, and he let go of that function completely. He then moved to a 2,000-square-foot warehouse that could handle all of the inventory, which created the need for an operations manager. He then hired a bookkeeper and let go of that function. The growth continued. Niche moved to a 10,000-square-foot warehouse. That created the need for a CFO and then a COO, as well as a head of site, stores, and marketing. Further growth required an 80,000-square-foot warehouse, and the story continues to this day. Tyler masterfully delegated and elevated each time he reached capacity, avoiding burnout. In addition, each member of the leadership team continues to delegate and elevate as the organization continues to grow. Evolution. As your organization grows, your accountability chart will constantly evolve and change. This is a dynamic tool. Think back to what your structure looked like when you were half your size. Now, imagine what it would look like at double the size. What are the differences? The point is that the accountability chart is an ever-evolving tool if you're growing. At a growth rate of 20%, you will make a change to the accountability chart about every 90 days. Scalability. When you build out your accountability chart, you will notice that certain functions require multiple people doing the same job. For example, salespeople, customer service representatives, accounting clerks. The accountability chart becomes scalable. Where multiple people have the same job, you simply put the number of people in that function rather than adding multiple new boxes. Your existing organizational chart. You may be wondering what to do with your existing organizational chart. Your newly created accountability chart should replace it and become the tool you use to illustrate the organizational structure. It clearly shows the reporting structure and the roles and responsibilities of each function. Keep it simple. The next step is to share it with everyone in your company. They'll appreciate knowing where they fit and what they are accountable for. From there, assuming they have your core values and GWC, let go of the vine and let them execute. You will experience the incredible results that come from harnessing all of their combined talents. Terminations. A word of caution. Now that you've created clarity, you'll clearly see the people that do not fit in the organization. Yet you shouldn't run out and fire them all. That would make you vulnerable as an organization and leave some gaping holes. Take a methodical approach to personnel changes, making sure that everyone on the leadership team is on the same page and then moving forward step by step. This doesn't give you an out, it just means that you can't put the company in a vulnerable position. You still have to make the change. Once, my parents went out of town at a time when my two teenage brothers and I still lived at home. Upon their return, my dad realized we hadn't watered my mom's plant, and it was quickly dying. We decided that overwatering it would do the trick, and of course it didn't. Upon noticing the problem, my mom simply grabbed a pair of scissors and pruned a few dying limbs. The plant came back to life a short time later. You must do a little pruning from time to time for the organization to flourish. Merely hoping that poorly fitting people will make it, sending them to a seminar or giving them a pep talk is like overwatering the plant. It isn't going to solve the problem. Once you do the necessary pruning, your organization will be revitalized. 36 hours of pain. If people must go and you're procrastinating because the prospect of firing them seems painful, hopefully this will give you some motivation. During the evolution of niche retail, Tyler Smith kept someone around for a year too long because he was having a really hard time making the decision to let the person go. What made it equally tough was this person had been with them through the early years. The company outgrew him, though. He was aware of this, and over time, his attitude had soured. The leadership team finally pulled out the people analyzer, and the results showed there was simply no other option. The person was no longer right for the organization. As a result, after much anguish and soul-searching, Tyler finally made the tough decision to let him go. A couple of days later, Tyler called me and shared a term that is now an EOS staple, 36 hours of pain. The hours leading up to and including the termination were painful. But after that point, he realized it was one of the best decisions he had made for the greater good of the company. He couldn't understand why he hadn't done it sooner. The work environment was so much better and less tense for everyone, he was relieved. Other employees thanked him for making the tough decision. He experienced all that pain for a year when, in hindsight, he could have experienced only 36 hours of pain, probably for both parties. Incidentally, the terminated gentleman is now doing well and pursuing his passion. The decision was best for all. If the people analyzer shows that someone is the wrong person for your organization, make the decision. And yes, there will be some pain, but only for about 36 hours. Keep two important points in mind. One, be careful what you wish for because you'll get it. If you want to grow, you have to understand that not everyone is going to be able to keep up and remain in the same seat forever. Two, keeping people around just because you like them is destructive. You're doing a disservice to the company, to everyone in it, and to the person. People must add value. I realize this may sound cold, but to the degree people are in the right seats, everyone is happier, especially them. The three questions to ask. When a client completes its accountability chart, we ask three questions to confirm that it is at 100%. Please ask these three questions with your leadership team. 1. Is this the right structure to get us to the next level? 2. Are all of the right people in the right seats? 3. Does everyone have enough time to do the job well? A yes on all three confirms that you're at 100% in this essential component. We now know what great leaders mean when they attribute their success to surrounding themselves with good people. It's putting the right people, core values, in the right seats, GWC, and unique ability. With your vision clear and shared by all, and with the right people in the right seats, the next step is measuring your progress and having an absolute pulse on your business. That requires the use of data. Summary: the people component. Right people, core values, the people analyzer. Right seats, accountability chart, GWC, get it, want it, capacity to do it. Chapter 5, the data component, safety in numbers. Picture a small plane flying over the Atlantic Ocean. Halfway across, the captain announces, "I've got bad news and I've got good news. The bad news is that the gauges aren't working. We are hopelessly lost. I have no idea how fast we're flying or in what direction, and I don't know how much fuel we have left. The good news is that we're making great time." Does that sound at all familiar? That's how most entrepreneurs run their organizations. They're flying blind with no data to let them gauge where they are going, or if they are heading in the right direction, but they always remain optimistic. Doubts can eat away at you. If you're a typical business owner, you often wake up at 2 a.m. with an uneasy feeling. You feel you can't accurately measure the pulse of your business. To take that pulse, you walk around the office the next day and talk to 5 different people. In the process, you waste a lot of your time and other people's, and after all that talking, what you have are subjective opinions, not hard data. Only factual information can provide the basis for productive discussion and decision-making. This chapter is designed to help you formulate and manage your data, to let you take the pulse of your business consistently and accurately, so that you can then take effective action. You will no longer be managing assumptions, subjective opinions, emotions, and egos. You will gain the power of being able to manage your business through a chosen handful of numbers. These numbers will allow you to monitor your business on a weekly basis, quickly showing which activities are on track or off track. Once you have tracked those numbers for a while, you will achieve the valuable ability to see patterns and trends to predict the future. For the data component, you will be introduced to a time-tested tool that will allow you to quantify your company's results. It's called a scorecard, and once you learn to use it, you'll be able to accurately read the pulse of your business. With hard data in hand, you'll sleep better at night. Ultimately, you will have the ability to let go of the vine and be better connected than ever. In addition, you will reach the point where everyone in your organization has a number, a meaningful, manageable, measurable. This will give them clear direction and increase productivity. Scorecard. According to an old business maxim, anything that is measured and watched is improved. The concept of managing through a scorecard has been around for a long time. The idea has been expressed through many different terms. It's been called a dashboard, flash report, scoreboard metrics, measurables, key performance indicators, smart numbers, and so on. Whatever you call it, it's a handful of numbers that can tell you at a glance how your business is doing. The unfortunate reality is that most organizations don't have a scorecard. They lack activity-based numbers to review on a regular basis. They might rely on a P&L, profit and loss statement, to tell them the score, but by then it's too late to make corrections. A profit and loss statement is a trailing indicator. Its data comes after the fact, and you can't change the past. With a scorecard, however, you can change the future. Let's look at someone who managed the most seemingly unmanageable beast of all using a scorecard. In his book, Leadership, Rudolph Giuliani says in a chapter aptly titled, Everyone's Accountable All of the Time, that one of the first things he did when he took over as mayor of New York City was to introduce CompStat. CompStat is a multi-level management tool that allows officers of the New York Police Department, NYPD, to report specific crime numbers on a daily or weekly basis. Giuliani says it enabled local precinct commanders to see patterns and trends, and then to react and deploy officers where necessary. In the past, the NYPD had merely tracked the number of arrests and the response times to 911 calls. But these are trailing indicators. By the time these numbers were received, quarterly or even annually, the pattern of crime would have changed. CompStat tracked crime activity on a daily and weekly basis, which Giuliani says allowed the NYPD to take the pulse of crime activity and thus gain the ability to prevent crime rather than just report it. In 8 years, murder figures went down by almost 70%, and overall crime went down by about 65%. In 1996, CompStat won the Innovations in Government Award from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Now, many cities are using the same type of tool. After the success of CompStat, Giuliani went on to unveil a citywide scorecard called CapStat, which allows a detailed performance evaluation of 20 city agencies. My business mentor, Sam Cupp, showed me how he used his scorecard to take the pulse of his companies, which totaled over $300 million in sales. In his teachings, he forced me to do the same with my business. In my first business, I was able to manage the entire company using 14 numbers. How many numbers you need to track depends on the type of business you have. Every company's scorecard is different. With over 400 EOS clients, there are over 400 different scorecards. Your scorecard will be unique to you and your organization. The following exercise will show you a step-by-step process for creating a scorecard that fits your unique business. Step 1. Spend an hour with your leadership team. Imagine you're on a desert island somewhere. None of you can talk to anyone, access email, or talk on the phone. All you have is a piece of paper with a handful of numbers on it. These numbers must allow you to have an absolute pulse on your business. What are all of the numbers that must be on that piece of paper? Decide and list all of the categories that you'd need to track on a weekly basis to have that pulse. These categories should include items such as weekly revenue, cash balances, weekly sales activity, customer satisfaction problems, accounts receivable and payable, and client project or production status, to name a few. As a rule of thumb, you should end up with 5 to 15 numbers, hopefully closer to 5. There is such a thing as too much information, so keep it simple. Once you've identified all the categories, you then plug them into your scorecard template. You list the categories under the category heading. Step 2. In the left-hand column, list who is accountable for each of the numbers. Only one person is ultimately accountable for each, and it's usually the person heading up that major function. This is the person who must deliver that weekly number to the organization, not the person who simply enters the number. For example, the head of sales and marketing is accountable for hitting the sales activity numbers, not the finance person who fills out the scorecard each week. Step 3. Decide and fill in what the expected goal is for the week in each category. Now that your VTO and vision are clear, the goal numbers in your scorecard should be tied directly to your one-year plan. Step 4. Put next week's date in the first date column in preparation for filling in your scorecard next week. Step 5. Decide who is accountable for collecting the numbers and fill in the scorecard every week for the leadership to review. Decide how that person will receive the numbers from each member. Step 6. Use it. You must review your scorecard every week to ensure that you're on track for your vision. The real magic of using a scorecard is not limited to managing it on a weekly basis. You will soon see 13 weeks, 3 months at a glance, which enables you to see patterns and trends. From there, the numbers roll, meaning that the first week will drop off the scorecard as the 14th week is added. Make sure you keep the numbers that drop off for future reference and historical data. 3 scorecard rules of thumb. 1. The numbers in the scorecard should be weekly activity-based numbers, not the type of high-level numbers you see in a profit and loss statement, P&L. Remember, this scorecard is not a P&L. It's based on numbers showing activity and telling you whether you're on track for a strong P&L. In other words, your scorecard predicts your P&L. What are activity-based numbers? To help clarify, let's look at a couple of examples. One category would be new revenue sales. If you only monitor revenue as it comes in, you'll react to downslides too late. Look at your sales process and follow the steps as far back as you can. Typically, you'll find that each step can be measured with a number. Take them in order, starting with the first step. Measure the number of the leads generated, the number of contacts, the number of appointments scheduled, the number of appointments attended, the number of proposals, and/or the number of closes. You decide how far back you want to measure because you can chase the process all the way back to the first step. Say, for instance, you choose number of new leads generated and track that number in the scorecard. By knowing the number of leads you have, you can see how many of the leads turn into contacts, how many contacts turn into appointments, and so on. By understanding these formulas and these ratios, you'll be able to predict the number of closes 2, 3, and sometimes 4 months down the road. This ultimately gives you the ability to predict and tells you how many leads you need to develop today. Another example of activity-based numbers is client satisfaction. If you merely track customer complaints or lost customers, that's too late as well. Instead, go to the first step in the process, finding out what factors drive both happy and unhappy customers. For instance, you might do a proactive numerical survey, such as asking 3 questions that require a number-based answer each time you close the business or deliver the product. As a result, you'll create leading indicators that allow you to track how you're doing. For instance, if on average you receive an 8.5 rating out of 10 in a certain area of your delivery and suddenly see an average rating of 7 for a series of 3 weeks, you know that a problem is brewing somewhere. You then have the opportunity to solve it before you potentially lose the customer. 2. The scorecard is much more of a proactive tool, helping you to anticipate problems before they actually happen. However, you still need to look at either monthly or quarterly financial statements and monitor a budget on a monthly or quarterly basis. 3. When managing a scorecard, many clients find value in red flagging categories that are off track. Red flagging occurs when one of your numbers does not hit or exceed the goal for the week. Shade that number so it stands out in the scorecard, usually using the color red. This can be programmed in an electronic spreadsheet or done manually. This creates better focus and awareness on that number, which creates more urgency in the weekly meeting. Your scorecard will evolve over the next several months. Assuming you've taken a good first cut, your categories should be about 85% right. That is close enough at this point. As your scorecard is brought to life in the succeeding chapters, it will evolve to 100%. On average, 3 months have to pass until it evolves into a tool you love. The scorecard should cause an organizational shift. Your leadership team will become more proactive at solving problems because you'll have had data that not only points out current problems, but also predicts future ones. By solving them, you're assuring them that you're on track with your vision. In order to solve a problem, you must know the source of the number in the scorecard. Therefore, you can go directly to the root cause and create better accountability and clarity with your people. That leads to the second part of the data component. Measurables. What gets measured gets done. Complete mastery of your data component is achieved when you boil the organization's numbers down to the point where everyone has a single, meaningful, manageable number to guide them in their work. This number will enable leaders to create clarity and accountability throughout their team. With a completed scorecard, you can track high-level numbers down to a single person as the source. Everyone has a number. The founder and chairman of a large Michigan mortgage company and a leading online mortgage lender once gave a talk at our Entrepreneurs Organization chapter. This was 16 years ago when I was running my first company and he had 75 employees. He's a fanatic about measuring everything. At one point, he told us that everyone has a number. He went on to explain how every employee in his organization has a number, even his receptionist. Hers was 2, as in 2 rings good, 3 rings bad. His speech was a wake-up call for me. Back at my office, I came up with and implemented a number for everyone. I have since taught this discipline to every client, and it has produced tremendous results. Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, contains an example illustrating the power that numbers can generate among your people. Charles Schwab ran Bethlehem Steel Company in the early 1900s, and he had a mill manager whose people weren't producing their work quota. One day Schwab asked him, "How is it that a manager as capable as you can't make this mill turn out what it should?" The mill manager didn't have an answer. He had tried everything. This conversation took place at the end of the day, just before the night shift came on. Schwab asked the manager for a piece of chalk and asked the nearest man how many heats, i.e. batches of refined steel, his shift had made that day. The man said 6. Without another word, Schwab chalked a big figure 6 on the floor and walked away. When the night shift came in, they saw the 6 and asked what it meant. The day people explained that Charles Schwab, the big boss, had asked how many heats they'd made and chalked the number down on the floor. The next morning, Schwab walked through the mill again and he found the night shift had rubbed out the 6 and replaced it with a big 7. When the day shift reported to work that morning, they too saw the 7 chalked on the floor and decided that they would show the night shift a thing or two. The crew pitched in with enthusiasm, and when they quit that night, they left behind them an enormous 10. It wasn't soon before this mill, which had been lagging way behind in production, was turning out more work than any other plant. That shows the power of giving everyone a number. In fact, there are 8 distinct advantages to everyone having a number. 1. Numbers cut through murky, subjective communication between manager and direct reports. As an example, where the old response between sales manager and salesperson regarding last week's sales activity was a vague Great, things are picking up. The new number-based answer is crystal clear. I got 3. If 3 is good for that company, then last week was great. If they needed to get 10, there is an issue to solve. Better to solve it now than 2 months from now when it shows up as poor revenue in the P&L. Numbers aren't just for the person. They become a communication tool between manager and direct report, creating the basis of comparison, unemotional dialogue, and ultimately, results. 2. Numbers create accountability. When you set a number, everyone knows what the expectation is. Accountability begins with clear expectations, and nothing is clearer than a number. For example, if in the accounting department the people's expectations are collections, that is unclear. However, if they are supposed to keep accounts receivable days below 40, balance below $100,000, or aged receivable less than $50,000, that is a clear expectation. The people know exactly what their target is. 3. Accountable people appreciate numbers. Wrong people in the wrong seats usually resist measurables. Right people in the right seats love clarity. Knowing the numbers they need to hit, they enjoy being part of a culture where all are held accountable. It creates an esprit de corps, with everyone pitching in to make the company a success because right people want to win. 4. Numbers create clarity and commitment. When an employee is clear on his or her number and agrees that he or she can achieve it, you have commitment. There is no gray area. A great example is the number Nordstrom uses with its salespeople, sales per hour. The number shows up on their paychecks, and perks are tied to it. Nordstrom salespeople know exactly what their sales expectations are, all the way down to an hourly basis. 5. Numbers create competition. Charles Schwab was able to create competition by making a target number known to all teams. Sure, they might experience some discomfort and a little stress, but there is nothing wrong with a little pressure. 6. Numbers produce results. Similar to the way Rudolph Giuliani helped turn a city around, you can create terrific results. If the customer service department's expectation is 0 unresolved customer issues, by hitting this number, you will achieve the ultimate result of customer retention and satisfaction. Or, if your customer service people are accountable for ancillary sales, and they know $1,000 in daily ancillary sales will reach the total ancillary sales goal, you'll typically hit it, or at least do better than if you don't provide this number. What gets watched improves. 7. Numbers create teamwork. When a team composed of the right people in the right seats agree to a number to hit, they ask themselves, how can we hit it, creating camaraderie and peer pressure. When a team of technicians are challenged to perform their service in 4 hours or less collectively, they will all pull together to figure out ways to achieve that number. The ones that aren't pulling their weight and hitting the number will be called out by the other team members that are. 8. You solve problems faster. When an activity-based number is off track, you can attack it and solve the problem proactively, unlike with an end-result-based number that shows up after it's too late to change it. In addition, the use of hard data cuts through all of the subjective and emotional opinions that create murkiness and lengthen the amount of time it takes to make the right decision. Todd Sash of Sash Construction immediately saw the value of everyone having a number, but struggled to persuade his leadership team to embrace the concept and understand the value as well. They assumed a backlash from the employees. He asked me to present the advantages to them, and Todd's people have now come to embrace the idea of numbers. His superintendents achieve 15-day turnaround times on punch lists. His accounting people keep accounts receivable under 30 days. Even his receptionist opens and hands out mail in less than 4 hours. He attributes everyone having a number as one of the key reasons that his organization grew 50% the following year. If you're still stuck, a great place to find numbers for your people is your completed accountability chart. Look at each of the five roles for each function. One, two, or three of those five roles can be measured by a number. For example, let's say a project manager's five major roles are as follows. Complete projects on time, achieve margin goal on each job, client satisfaction, weekly reporting in on time, achieve quality standards. Of these five, you can measure on time, margin, client satisfaction, and possibly quality standards. With the tabulation of data, your organization accomplishes the third essential component of gaining traction. With the vision clear, people in place, and data being managed through a scorecard, you're creating a transparent organization where there is nowhere to hide. Your company is open and honest. Any obstacles that stand in the way of achieving your vision will be apparent. Your job is to now remove those barriers and solve the issues holding you back. Summary: the data component. Scorecard. 5 to 15 high-level weekly numbers. Lets you have a pulse and gives you the ability to predict. Measurables. Everyone has a number. The 8 advantages to everyone having a number. Chapter 6. The issues component. Decide. The fourth essential component of gaining traction is having the discipline to face and solve your organization's issues as they arise. When the vision is clear, the people are in place, and you're managing data, you will inevitably find out what's holding you back. Successful companies solve their issues. They don't let them linger for weeks, months, and years at a time. Problems are like mushrooms. When it's dark and rainy, they multiply. Under bright light, they diminish. In an organization where there is nowhere to hide, the problems are easily illuminated. EOS will create that strong light. It's human nature to put off making a hard decision. If given the option, most people would prefer not to address an issue and hope that it goes away on its own. This reluctance to act can be a drag on growth and is extremely frustrating to watch. As Napoleon Bonaparte said, "Nothing is more difficult and therefore more precious than to be able to decide." Your ability to succeed is in direct proportion to your ability to solve your problems. The better you are at solving problems, the more successful you become. This is not a new discovery. In the classic book Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill cited a study that analyzed 25,000 people who had experienced failure. Lack of decision or procrastination was one of their major causes of failure. In contrast, analysis of several hundred millionaires revealed that every one of them had the habit of reaching decisions promptly and changing them slowly. Most leadership teams spend their time discussing the heck out of everything, but rarely solving anything. What is draining your energy is not having a lot of work to do. Rather, it's having unresolved issues. You're about to learn a process that helps leadership teams quickly dig to the root of an issue, discuss solutions, and then decide, therefore keeping them moving forward and giving them energy by pulling up the anchors holding them back. The one statement that summarizes this chapter best is a maxim my dad taught me long ago. It is less important what you decide than it is that you decide. More is lost by indecision than by wrong decisions. When most new clients solve their major issues in the early stages of the process, they typically say, "That one has been around for years," or "We've been trying to solve that issue forever." Each unresolved issue is an incomplete project, weighing down your organization and holding you back. You only have so much capacity, and these unresolved issues take up time and energy. Ultimately, you or your organization will implode under the burden. By solving these issues, you'll free up capacity, creating more time and energy. In this Issues component chapter, you'll learn the next two EOS tools to wield against obstacles holding your company back. The first is a discipline of creating an issues list. The second is the issues solving track. Once you set them up, you'll knock those obstacles down. The issues list. It's normal to have issues. The sooner you can admit that you have them and not view that as negative thinking or some kind of a weakness, the faster you will move forward. The good news is that there are only a handful of issues in the history of business. The same ones crop up over and over again. What changes is your ability to solve them. The key is to create an environment that smokes them out. A vital first step is creating a workplace where people feel comfortable calling out the issues that stand in the way of your vision. To do this, your leadership team must be comfortable with this type of environment. My only expectation with every EOS client is that they be open and honest with each other. To the degree that your leadership becomes open and honest, you will end up with an open and honest organization. As goes the leadership team, so goes the company. If the leadership team is open and honest, issues will flow freely. No one has ever died from being open about issues. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. Start with your leadership team meetings, and this behavior will trickle down throughout the entire organization. The result is an environment in which everyone feels comfortable being open and honest about everything. If, on the other hand, the leadership team is not healthy, the organization never will be. In The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, Patrick Lencioni makes the point that a high level of trust is the foundation of what makes teams healthy and functional. In Managing by Values, authors Ken Blanchard and Michael O'Connor write that communication happens naturally when you make the work environment safe. Trust creates an open culture in which everyone feels comfortable talking about issues as they arise. You cannot achieve this openness if people in the organization fear losing their jobs or some other terrible ramification. Therefore, trust starts with you. You set the tone by openly admitting mistakes and issues and then working together to solve them. Everyone must know that it's okay to raise issues as long as they are corrected. The issues list is meaningless if no one ever puts anything useful on it. The way to get meaningful issues on the list is to create open and honest teams. When your accountability chart is complete, your organization will be made up by a handful of teams. Each must be healthy, starting with your leadership team. As each team becomes healthier, you will notice issues flowing more freely and the trust level increasing. With an open and honest organization, the issues list becomes a tool that creates a discipline to keep all of your issues out in the open and organized in one place. There should be three types of issues lists in your organization. 1. The issues list in your Vision Traction Organizer, VTO. These are all company issues that can be shelved beyond 90 days. These issues are tackled in future quarterly meetings. The issues that are not a big enough priority for this week or this quarter must be stored somewhere so that you don't lose sight of them. The VTO issues list is the place for that. This list will include issues as diverse as new product ideas, key employee issues, technology needs, office relocation, capital needs, and the need for HR policies. They'll go there if this is not the quarter to solve them because you have bigger fish to fry. 2. The Weekly Leadership Team Issues List. The time frame on these items is much shorter. These are all of the relevant issues for this week and quarter that must be tackled at the highest level. These issues will be resolved in your weekly leadership team meetings. You should not be solving departmental issues. These will typically be more strategic in nature. If it can be solved at a departmental level, push it down. Leadership issues include things as diverse as company rocks being off track, a bad number in the scorecard, key employee issues, major client difficulties, and process and system-related problems. 3. The departmental issues list. These issues are on a more local level. These include all the relevant departmental issues for the week that must be tackled during the weekly departmental meetings. The sales team might have hitting call numbers, presentations, closing business, marketing, and presentation materials on their list, while the operations team might have fulfilling orders, purchasing, customer complaints, and low production numbers on theirs. A client shared a great idea that he used when he was having a hard time getting the people in his department to be open and honest in the identification and resolution of issues. For his next meeting, he made it mandatory that everyone bring two issues. If someone did not have two, he or she could not attend the meeting. He said it was the best meeting his team had ever had. With the floodgates opened, they are healthier than ever. With an open and honest culture and the three issues lists clear, issues will start flowing freely. You can now compartmentalize each issue onto the appropriate list. Each issue that arises in your organization has a place, which means you have to start working on solving them. The most effective way to do that is by following the issues solving track. The issues solving track. When addressing issues, leadership teams spend most of their time discussing the heck out of everything, rarely identifying anything, and hardly ever solving something. It's truly an epidemic within the business world. Most teams suffer from different challenges when solving issues. The common ones include fear of conflict, lack of focus, lack of discipline, lack of commitment, and personal ego. There are scores of different issue resolution models and approaches, but most people find them too complex and time-consuming. Some of the more detailed conflict resolution and problem-solving techniques require hours of preparation and mountains of paperwork. There is a better, faster, and more efficient way. After observing this phenomenon for many years, I created a simple tool that allowed my clients to resolve their issues. It's called the Issues Solving Track. The Issues Solving Track consists of three steps. 1. Identify. 2. Discuss. 3. Solve. To start, you must first examine your issues list and quickly decide on the top three issues to be solved. Do not make the mistake of starting at the top of your issues list and working your way down. If the most important issue is seventh on the list, you will rarely handle that many issues in one sitting, and as a result, you will not get to the most important one. In addition, when you take them in order of priority, a few issues will fall off the list because they turn out to be symptoms of the real issue you solved. For example, say you decide that the most important issue is that the handoff process from sales to operations is ineffective. After solving it, you might realize that the first and second issues on the list, frustration with the sales team and slow project starts, were also symptoms of the same thing. As a result, they go away on their own. Assuming you've decided what the three most important issues are, start with the most important and follow the issues solving track. Step 1. Identify. Clearly identify the real issue, because the stated problem is rarely the real one. The underlying issue is always a few layers down. Most of the time, the stated problem is a symptom of the real issue, so you must find the root of the matter. By batting the issue back and forth, you will reach the true cause. Plan on getting a little bit uncomfortable. Most causes of real issues are people. The discussion can hit close to home if either someone on the leadership team or one of his or her staff is responsible. You have to be able to talk about